Okay, good evening and welcome to all of our Jewish Center members and our many guests. Wonderful to be with you. You know, since the Jewish Center was founded almost 100 years ago, we've maintained an abiding interest in the intersection of the arts and sciences on the one hand and Torah values on the other. First and foremost, we identify as Jews committed to Hashem and to his mitzvos. At the same time, we're proud citizens of the world. Thinking consciously about how Torah and Mada come together is something we take very seriously. And as we complete the book of Vayikra this week, it's all the more appropriate to consider what the notions of Kedusha and sanctity mean today. How the Torah's eternal principles apply to the public discourse of contemporary ethics. So it's with a deep sense of appreciation that I want to take this opportunity to thank Mr. Hanno Mott, not only for sponsoring tonight's conversation, but for bringing to our center his passion for intellectual curiosity. We freely confess that we may not have all the answers, but we take great pride in being able to host events like this one, where we can grapple with the difficult questions. Hanno, thank you for making all of this possible. We're privileged to have with us this evening two outstanding individuals who have agreed to share their expertise with us. Rabbi Saul Berman is known to all of us from his myriad contributions to Jewish life, both here in New York City and throughout the world. He's a profound thinker, a prolific writer, and a master teacher. In addition to his rabbinic work, Rabbi Berman has served as chairman of the Department of Judaic Studies of Stern College for Women at Yeshiva University. Is currently a Rotter Fellow and Professor of Ethics at Columbia University's Law School. Now, back when I was in Tzmicha, I lived up on 104th Street, and I would often daven at Ramat Arah, where I had the good fortune on a number of occasions to learn directly from Rabbi Berman. His warmth, his clarity, and the power of his oratory have remained with me ever since. Now, I've known Rabbi Berman for around the last 15 years. I'm afraid I've only gotten to know Dr. Loike over the last, say, 15 minutes. But his reputation as an outstanding scholar precedes him. He's the director for special programs for the Center for Bioethics and is the co-director of the graduate studies program in the Department of Physiology and Cellular Biophysics in Columbia University at the College of Physicians and Surgeons. He's also an advisory board member of the Columbia University Center for the Study of Science and Religion, creator and faculty editor of the Columbia University Journal of Bioethics. I'm going to ask Dr. Loike to begin by sharing with us the science that forms the background of this evening's conversation. Rabbi Berman is going to respond by talking about the social and ethical considerations and the public policy considerations of these issues. We're then going to move into some questions and give our guests an opportunity to respond and discuss the issues more fully. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. John Loike.
Thank you very much. Can everybody hear me? All right. Thank you very much. For me, it's a great honor and a privilege to be speaking in an institution like the Jewish Center, which has such a rich history of intellectual pursuits. It's really, I'm very privileged and honored for the invitation and for the sponsorship, and I thank you all. And I'm humbled to speak with Rabbi Berman, who I also respect and have known and read about his works quite a great deal. I want to make some introductory remarks before I go into my talk. The first thing is, I'm not a rabbi. I'm not a posse. Any divrei halacha that I say is from Rabbi Tendler, Moshe Tendler, who I've been writing with on these issues for the last almost 14 years. And so if you ask me a halachic issue, if I don't know, I'll say I don't know. But if I do give an answer, it's usually, I hope, respectfully through Rabbi Tendler. The second thing is, I want to give you a little historical perspective. In the late 50s, in the early 60s, there are only a few individuals in the world who are dealing with Jewish medical ethics. There's, of course, Fred Rosner, Rabbi Tendler, Lord Jacobowitz, and a few others. And they really instituted a whole movement so that today, we're in an environment, a Jewish environment, where we have rabbis who know medicine, we have physicians who know Rabbanut. It's wonderful. It's a really asset to our Jewish community. Over the last 10 years, the whole landscape of science is changing dramatically. And now there is a need, and this is why I'm here, to perpetuate the same sort of development, where we can now train scientists in halacha, rabbis and posting in science. This is very complicated science. Genetics, molecular biology is not trivial. It's going to take years. And we need both the financial support and the participation of the audience to really get this going so that in the next, hopefully, 5 or 10 years, we can establish the same sort of expertise in bioethics as we've done with medical ethics. Okay, with this in mind, let me begin by telling you what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to first present the newest technology in human cloning, potential medical applications. I'll give you 3 bioethical challenges and some possible resolutions, which Rabbi Berman and you can discuss. When you think about cloning, there's some basic information you have to know. The first thing is that genes are units of genetic material that code for specific traits. We all know that. And the DNA is the hereditary material. They're composed of about 3 million base pairs. Now we've added 2 synthetic ones. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. And they really, it's found in one location in the cell called the nucleus. There's another organelle in every cell called the mitochondria that also has a very small amount of DNA, but very important DNA, as you'll see. And the other thing is that only 5% of this code is involved in direct production of proteins. The other 95% used to be called junk DNA, but we all know God does not produce junk. And today we're learning more and more that this other 95% is very important in regulating the whole genetic code. Now, we're going to begin with a little history of cloning. Cloning was initiated in 1997 by Ian Wilmot and his group in Edinburgh. It was a remarkable, remarkable breakthrough accomplishment. In fact, were it not for the bioethical challenges and concerns, they should receive the Nobel Prize for what they did. It destroyed biological dogmas in many areas, and it was really a remarkable thing. And since 1997, over 20 animals have been cloned using a technology called somatic cell nuclear transfer. I'll explain that in a few minutes. But until last year, it never worked in humans. It worked in cats, mice, horses, dogs, etc. What's important, right, before we go back, what's really important here is that this was the turning event for me to get into bioethics. Because when I read the paper, I said, whoa, they did a great job proving what they wanted to do, that they could take a non-sperm, non-egg cell, a human, it was a cell from a mammary gland of one sheep, and use that to generate an embryo. But they forgot to look at the mitochondrial DNA. So I called them up and I said, all right, Ian, send me some of Dolly's tissue and we'll do the genetics of the mitochondrial DNA, which we did. And when they sent us the samples, around that same time, the New York Times, the Post, all the papers came out with terrible articles saying that this is impossible. Because it gives all dogma, it must be fraud. Now, as a scientist, I know the first rule about fraud. If you engage in scientific fraud, never send your samples away from your lab. So I knew that they were right, and they were. And once I began to read the articles more closely, I realized, my God, the public nor the media really understand what's going on here. So I began to write about this, and that's how I got involved. I began writing, and then Columbia asked me to teach a course, and I've been doing this ever since. Okay. So let me go through what it is. You start out with a donated egg on the left. You can take a skin cell, a blood cell, it doesn't make any difference. And you remove the nucleus from the donated egg, just pluck it out, easy. And then you have what's called the nucleated oocyte, or egg, next. And then what you do is you take this, remove the nucleus from the skin of the blood cell. All right, and take that nucleus and inject it into the egg. Very simple, physically injected. And then you reconstitute this what's called a fertilized egg. No sperm. You're taking an egg without a nucleus. You take the nucleus from a donor egg, and you get the fertilized egg brought up, and then you generate what's called the blastocyst. The blastocyst is the key element. Once you successfully have a blastocyst, then that's your gateway to clone. And that is a key element. That's all the traumatic cell nuclear transfer is. Very simple. Now, what can you do with human cloning? There's two things you can do. Either you can use this process to generate a stem cell line. That's how they generate stem cells. It's very effective. These stem cells are the golden standard for all stem cell research. And that's what most of the people did. And that's what most of the research is focused on. But also, you can use it for reproduction and generate a human being. But I told you, since 1997 until 2013, nobody could even generate this blastocyst. We're using human cells. Next. So the first bioethical issue I'm going to raise, and what I'm going to do is raise some issues, and we'll discuss them at the end, but I just want you to think about them as you hear these. Is human cloning an inappropriate technology? Are we playing God? Is it wrong for us to do this type of technology? And of course, we're faced with famous Michelangelo's, you know, that's what he did, you know, what, 500 years ago, but today, this is what he would be doing. About a year ago, almost exactly a year ago, Mitropov at University of Oregon did an amazing thing. He actually got this technique to work with human cells. I could go into this, spend an hour telling you how he did it. It's not only what he did, how he did it, but it has tremendous ramifications in terms of IVF and infertility, but he was really successful. And basically, since then, stuff has been repeated. And now we have two other articles, one from Columbia, where they can reprogram cells from a diabetic person to generate a cell line from a diabetic. We could then probably correct that mutation, re-inject the same cells into the person, and maybe treat, won't cure, maybe treat diabetes. Amazing stuff. And just recently, they just did another group, used nuclear transfer using adult cells from a 35-year-old and a 75-year-old volunteer. It's really here and now. Now, I want to tell you a funny thing about the first time he was done. How did he do it? I won't go into it too much today, but one of the things he did is that he incubated this enucleated egg and the skin cell with caffeine to slow down. Because what the egg has to do, it has to reprogram and realign the DNA that it receives to make sure it's the right format. And by incubating the materials with caffeine, it really slowed it down. So there's a Musser House study. If you want to improve your fertility, right? After you have relations, take your wife out to Starbucks. Next. All right. What are the clinical benefits of cloning? First of all, it could generate stem cells with specific diseases. No longer is there breast cancer, is there colon cancer. They're all different forms. By knowing the specific cancer, knowing the specific tumor, you can know how to treat it. There's amazing progress being done in this stuff. And by generating stem cells from individuals with their specific diseases, we can study the diseases, figure out how to cure it, and it's going to revolutionize personal medicine the way you can't even believe. The second benefit, we can enable women who have mitochondrial defects to have healthy children. And I'll go into that in a few minutes. And the third thing, it's going to provide new therapies for men and women who have fertility problems. Next. Let's focus a little bit on mitochondrial diseases. Turns out, I told you in the mitochondria, there's a small amount of DNA, about 16,000 nucleotides, as opposed to 3 billion in the rest of the cell. But these are very important. Women who have mutations in some of these, this DNA, they have severe neuromuscular problems. Some even have muscular dystrophy. And every one of their children has a very almost probabilistic incidence of getting the same disease. So if they want to have healthy children, how can we use the technology? And this is what we can do. The mitochondria is like the energy center of the world, of the cell, and about 7,000 children are born with this disorder, which causes I told before. Now, this somatic cell nuclear transfer cloning technology, these children can be generated using the mitochondria from a healthy woman and transferring it to the egg and sperm of the couple. So, and the aim here is to replace the faulty mitochondria, and it works. Let me tell you something, it works. It was done, federated 10 children in the past 10 years that have done successfully using a modified version of this, and Columbia is now initiating a whole new initiative to get this going again. Next. So here, this is how you remove it, and what you're going to get is super mitochondria, and all the children are going to be healthy, and their children are going to be healthy as well. There's profound therapeutic things. And this is basically how it works. You take the mitochondria from one egg and you put it into the donor egg and you fertilize it. And even though you don't remove any of the mitochondria from the affected woman, by putting enough mitochondria healthy, you overcome, in general, this defect. And it really works. Next. Now here's the second biological challenge. We talked about medical applications. The second one is creating human beings or embryos from multiple parents. So with this mitochondrial defect, you have three donors, three potential genetic contributors. The woman who donates the mitochondria, the woman who donates her egg, and the man who donates the sperm. Three parents generating a child. In monkeys, we can generate monkeys from six parents. Now, why would human beings want to do this? Maybe genetic diversity, racial, you know, integration. There are a lot of reasons why it's doable, and it'll work in human beings. So what do we do? How do we deal with creating human beings from multiple parents? Next. And here comes the third biological challenge. How does halakha define zera? We all know that in the Torah they talk about that the sperm is the source of the man's contribution, and even there's good evidence that at least the Torah knew about the egg, even though maybe medieval commentaries didn't, because the pasuk says vishakti pasriya, when a woman conceives, and probably refers to the egg. But when the halakha talks about zera, seed, does it mean that it could only be sperm, a cell obtained from the presence of a man? Or does halakha expand its thing to say any cell that has the potential to create a human embryo will be defined as zera? Why is this important? Because heritage, right? If you have a child, who is the halakha father? That's why this is so important. So now I've told you the science, very simple. Now let's go into some of the challenging halakhic ramifications. Let's go one at a time. Is human cloning inappropriate? So, first of all, it's not man-made. It's not like synthetic biology. There is a precedent. You have a reptile in New Zealand that is all female. Next slide. This reptile, no male species. It reproduces itself by cloning. Next. You have this ant. Also, they're reproduced by cloning. They're very poisonous, so be careful. And the third thing, of course, are self-pollinating trees. One gamete, and of course, identical twins. Next. So identical twins are clones. They're genetically the same. So there is a biological precedent. It's not man-made. Next. And there is a very important directive that is summarized by the Rambam in his Bereishit. And he says that human beings, Jews, human beings, have to be partners with HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the creation process. And he says that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave the directive and the power for human beings to do what they want for the benefit of humanity, with animals, with insects, anything, to, as long as you're doing it as in a positive, beneficial purpose, you are serving as creators in God's creation in order to better human condition. So we have this directive that we are allowed to manipulate any organism in order to improve our health. So, the other thing you have to recognize, whether this technology is inappropriate, is that this technology does not involve any halakhic prohibitions. Taking one cell, putting it to another, creating this reconstituted egg, there's nothing wrong with it. Remember, in Judaism, in halakhic Judaism, most modern poskim and even older poskim believe that it's not until you implant that fertilized egg into the woman that's when it counts as being acquiring parenthood. In the laboratory, it has a certain level of kedusha, but a very minimal level, and you're allowed to discard it. But study, you should give it for research, but it doesn't involve any really halakhic prohibition. And the Tiferes Yisrael says it very directly. Anything that we have no reason to prohibit is permitted in halakha without having to find a reason for its permissibility. For the Torah does not mention every permissible thing, but rather only those things which are forbidden. A very important principle, especially in today's world. Next. Now we deal with the second bioethical principle, halakha. How do you create human embryos from multiple parents? In halakha, can there be more than two parents? Well, the Torah seems to say zachar nekeva, right? Who is a mitzvah with one man and one woman? That, but and also there's a gemara mitzvah, which I'll show you in a few minutes, that takes three partners in the creation of human being: man, woman, and God. And the third thing is, how is Goliath? It's the only source I've ever found. Goliath, as you know, was a very famous enemy of the Jews, that David took care of. And in Sota, it describes how his mother, Ophrah, from the very famous story of Ruth that we'll be reading in a few weeks, slept with 100 different men one evening. He gave birth to this giant. Now, Rashi says that only one man can be the biological, can be the father. Whether he meant biological, halakhic father, I don't know. But that's what Rashi says. Tosfot says, no, several men can serve as a father. The only source I found, and I hope I get some other sources about this. And again, it's unclear whether they're talking biologically or halakhically. But so the issue is, can you create an embryo from a, how does halakha deal with more than one parent? More than two parents, I'm sorry. So this is the famous gemara that everybody quotes. It says there are three shtutfin, there are down three partners, you can read it, and the God, each one makes a contribution. And the real issue here is whether this is this a preference or a halakhic directive. Is this Gemara saying this is the only way, or saying no, this is the preferred way of reproduction, but if you can, if you need to correct infertility, other ways are allowed. So is it an imperative or is it just a preference? So now we come to the third biological challenge, is how does halakha define zera? So here, Rabbi Tandler has a remarkable chiddush, unbelievable, which I think is really right. That doesn't make sense what I think. And it's based on several statements. One is Rav Shurban, who says that our chachamim were not physicians. They used the best of their knowledge to prescribe medicine and to rely on physicians for their advice and medical advice. And more important, the Rambam's dictum on capital crimes is very revealing. It says doctors should establish whether a specific injury is life-threatening or not. In other words, in areas of capital punishment, and you know, this is one of the premier mitzvahs, right? You rely on the experts of the time. Thus, scientific consensus, this is the Chiddush, can serve as a basis of halakhic decisions and is a precedent for addressing new halakhic issues from these reproductive. So what it means is as follows. In science, every scientist believes that the contributors of the genetic information, the DNA, constitute the embryo. So what Teller is saying is that this dictum should apply to halacha as well. And that is that if a man donates skin or blood cell instead of his sperm, he's still considered the halachic father of the child. Very, very progressive. And I want you to know, there's no precedent for this anywhere in the Torah except what I told you. And it's reminiscent about when IVF, when surrogacy and IVF first came around, a good friend of mine, Avraham Steinberg, brother, Dr. Avraham Steinberg, was reading a lot about medical ethics. He went to Rav Shlomo Zalman, who was the host of the Torah of the Talmud, and he asked him, what do you do about surrogacy, gestational surrogacy, where you have a woman carrying an egg and a sperm from a Jewish couple, and is she Jewish, not Jewish, how do you do this? And he said to Avraham, I've never come across a case like this where there's no halakhic precedent. But today, about 20 years later, we're coming up with more and more cases. And we have a formula, we have a way of doing this. But this is really a remarkable idea. So we propose that anyone who contributes to genetic information is the halakhic father and maybe even the halakhic mother. Next. So now, should genetics be the sole halakhic determinant in parenthood? And that's not necessarily true. We have a lot of situations where genetics doesn't apply to halakhic fatherhood. For example, a child fathered by a non-Jew with a Jewish woman has a genetic father, but halakhically is Jewish by virtue of the fact that the mother is Jewish, but that genetic father has no halakhic bearing on the gender, on the child. Second exception, a child fathered by a Jewish man who has lived with a non-Jewish woman is not granted halakhic familial status with the child. Even though he is the genetic father, the child is not Jewish. The third example is any child that converts to Judaism severs most familial relationships with respect to parents and fatherhood and even siblings. So you have cases where genetic is not all in everything in terms of halakha, but still is a very major thing. And finally, a child who is fathered by a Kohen, who impregnated a Jewish divorcee, does not transmit the kahuna status of the child, even though the Kohen is recognized as halakhic fathers. So these are the exceptions. But in terms of halakhic fatherhood, giving a skin or sperm cell to generate a child is going to be, I think, accepted. And then what is this related to? Of course, whether, you know, when we talk about free parenthood or any of these issues, we have to talk about laws of Arayim, Rovin, Kohen, Levi, Mishra lineage, honoring parents, Hebrew inheritance, Hebrew inheritance. These are all the ramifications, and I'm not going to go into each one of them. I'm just going to give you an overview of how complex this whole issue is. So now, let's go slowly here. Here are the challenges that we're going to face, and hopefully Rabbi Berman and I will discuss some of these things. You fuse a skin cell from an infertile Jewish husband with the egg of a Jewish wife to create an embryo. Well, that's the easy case. I told you. We think this will be allowed, and that Jewish husband and that wife will be the legal parents. Next. Fuse a skin cell with an egg from one woman to clone herself. We can do it. I don't know we will. I'll give you a prediction. The Rav always said, never predict the future. It's very dangerous. But you can always predict the past. But I'm going to put my reputation on the line. In the next 10 or 15 years, you're going to have a nice picture of a cute little girl with pigtails that was born by cloning. And she'll make Time magazine or one or the other, and then it'll be accepted. That's how it was in 1978, when the first test tube baby, Louise Brown, no IRB, no regulator would have approved in vitro fertilization. But once you have a cute little girl without any problems on the picture, you'll see that all of a sudden cloning is going to be reinitiated as a possible therapeutic modality. It's interesting. When Ian Wilman cloned Dolly the sheep, never in his article or in his title is the word clone used, because he knew that cloning elicited a lot of bioethical concerns. But it didn't help. They even hired an agency to suppress all the debates. But once that article came out, the whole world went crazy with debating about the issue of cloning, even though he never used the word clone. Next. So can we clone a person? Can we clone a woman? I don't know. Third issue. Take a skin cell, a blood cell from a Jewish man, and with an egg from a Jewish married woman that is not married to create an embryo. Are we engaged in Arab as a mamzer? What is the status of that? Fourth, create an embryo from multiple parents. And one would predict that anybody who contributes genetic information should be a parent. But the question is how much? In halakha, there's a concept of shir. Is giving 1.1% of the DNA sufficient to confer parenthood? Or can one say that, well, it's not a shir, it's a very small amount, but it's very important. It's a very important thing, and without it, everything changes, so maybe it has halakhic status. And that's what we're debating on now. Next. Very briefly, most of the big machlokas among very poskim, whether this type of technology involves with zeirut, especially if you're not having with non-married people, and there are three different shitas. It's either a mamzer, a suffered mamzer, or a child is not illegitimate. There are three different, all across the board. And the Kendra believes, based on his motion and others, that there is, since there's no forbidden marital act involved, the kid is actually not a mamzer. And that's a statement. So now, those are some of the issues we're going to discuss. Now let me just stimulate your mind with two things that come up, has come from last month, which are really remarkable. First, is that we can generate viable male and female mice from two fathers.
That's right.
I don't want to go into details. Easy to do. They've done it. Two fathers. Now, you take with uterine transplantation, you take the uterus from a man's mother, transplant it himself, and now we can, they generate an embryo where one of the men can actually gestate that is. Okay? So all you need from a woman is the enucleated egg. But again, I hate to predict, but in about 10 years you won't even need it. As we begin to understand what is the power of this egg, we can use any egg to serve as a vehicle for fertilization, so to speak. And this just came out, and this is remarkable. There are two genes in the Y chromosome. You know, a male has an X and a Y chromosome, and a female has an XX chromosome. And there are two genes in the Y chromosome that if I transplant into the X chromosome, I can have two women can generate a male child, a fully functional male. Now this creates unbelievable intellectual halakhic situations. Because you have two women, one of them gestate, there's no man involved, and of course, if both the women are Jewish, the child is Jewish. Suppose one of the women is a Bach Kohen, and one, or they're both Bach Kohen, what's the status of the child? Is a Kohen lady show? If one is, if they're Levia, Bach Levia, what's the status? If one is a Kohen, one's a lady, one is Shoah, you can, it goes on and on and on. And these are issues which we haven't resolved yet, but they're fascinating from a halakhic perspective. So, what are some future halakhic considerations? I told you, fusing nucleus from two women, using two men, right? Now we can use 40 people. I call it 40 because we always infuse a neshama when we create a thing. To customize, and now, over the last 2 weeks, they have now expanded our genetic code to have two synthetic base pairs. I don't know why, but it's going to revolutionize synthetic biology. That's a different talk.
Can you just explain how you generate a functioning embryo from two females with no male?
Oh, very simple. You take...
Where do you get a Y chromosome?
Where do you get a Y chromosome? You take those two genes from the Y chromosome and you transfer them into one of the X's.
So you need a donor of a Y chromosome?
No, you can do it synthetically.
But you need to get...
You synthesize those genes in the lab. You synthesize them in the lab, put them in. Okay, so now we go back to Shlomo HaMelech. Remember the famous case, right? Here's the baby. Two mothers say, it's my baby. What Shlomo, at that time, had only one option. Should he split the baby in half, or should he clone it? Next. Conclusion. Good halakhic decisions start with good facts. It's very important. Good scientific facts. Second, in research and medicine, your actions should be guided not by what you can do, but rather what you should do. I mean, the cartoon, the cartoons say it very well. Your DNA test shows that you're predisposed to pseudopathies. Very true. Now we can do PGD, right? Pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, to remove those genes that will remove malpractice, okay? And of course you have the other cartoon. As you can see from your genetic printout, you only think you're depressed. In fact, you're a jolly, happy person full of joy of food. Okay? So, next. Finally, I think this is really important, what Albert Einstein said, concern for man himself and his fate must always form the chief interest of all technological endeavors. in order that the creations of our mind shall be a blessing and not a curse. And I think that's a very profound statement and very consistent with the halakhic philosophy. And of course, whenever I quote Einstein, I always have a complaint. Couldn't you make the speed of light and leave a number? Okay. Finally, last but not least, we will have questions and we'll hear from Rabbi Berman, and then you can be able to ask those questions. I hope that was clear.
Good evening, everybody. Firstly, thank you, Rabbi Levine, for your kind words of introduction. I have, for certainly over 10 years, been reading articles jointly written by Dr. Loike and Rabbi Tendler, and it was my pleasure just a little over a year ago, I guess, to have met him and begun a conversation, which I hope will continue tonight. And for many years, Dr. Loike is an extraordinarily important resource for us in the religious community, because he combines extraordinarily special competence in the sciences, as well as a religious and halachic sensitivity that is not quite as common. So this Shabbat we're going to be reading Parshat Bechukotai, which has blessings and curses, brachot and klalot. And we have the both fortune and misfortune to be living in an era of both curses and blessings. And so we live in the era of the Holocaust, and we live in the era of the birth of the State of Israel. We live in the era in which a nuclear bomb was dropped and human beings were killed. And we live in that same era in which nuclear energy has the opportunity to provide us with a way of avoiding our destruction of much of nature. And in reverse order, we live in as a blessing in the era of the internet, but which bears with it also the curse of the iPhone. We live in an era in which there is an extraordinary blessing of chachamim who do not hide from new technology, who do not simply say chadash asur min haTorah, and that whatever is new in technology should be forbidden. And that's a great blessing to live in this era. At the same time, we live in an era which is cursed with the absence of any mechanism whatsoever by which resolution of deeply conflicting opinions in halakha and in hashkafa can be achieved, except through mechanisms which are not exactly favorable to us, and that is adopting the position that is most chamur, adopting the position that is most severe, or in a slightly different form, to be choshesh l'chol adayot, to be concerned for every possible opinion, and to assert that if there is any opinion that maintains that something is forbidden, that that one can't go there. And living as we do in this particular generation, we have to take cognizance of the realities of halachic debate and of ideological diversity, and the ways in which those debates and that diversity impact on the potential use of contemporary technology. All that Professor Loike said about halakhic issues is accurate, but the reality is that there is intense unresolved debate about virtually every area of halakha that he mentioned, and that those unresolved debates have stymied the use of technology in a variety of areas, that could otherwise be deeply beneficial. I'll restrict myself to mentioning issues related to reproductive technology, because they've been much less impactful on therapeutic technology. But in the area of reproductive technology, the reality is that there is intense unresolved debate related to the question of how to define maternity, with Rabbi Tendler and Rabbi Bicker and others maintaining that genetics should be the sole basis of establishing halachic maternity. On the other hand, with a lengthy tradition now of maintaining that nurturing and birth should be established as the basis of maternity. The position of Rabbi Bleich maintains that, in fact, halacha needs to recognize the existence of two mothers, one based on genetics, the other based on nurturing and birth. A further position that is now in the process of evolving, led by Rabbi Nachum Rabinovich, who maintains that the will of the parties needs to be a factor in determining maternity, so that in surrogacy you can have the establishment of halachic maternity based either on genetics or on nurturing and birth, albeit there would be a preference for genetics, but if the genetic, quote-unquote genetic mother were to waive her right, then the woman who nurtures and gives birth to the child should be deemed halachically to be the sole mother. That is, Rabbi Rabinovich maintains there should be only one mother, but that that mother could be determined either by genetics or by nurturing and birth. And the fact is that in the face of all of this debate, there is an enormous restraint on the use of the technology, because the reality is that status as a Jew is affected. The question of what happens if the genetic mother, let's say an ovum donor, for example, is not Jewish, but the woman who bears, who nurtures and gives birth to the child is the child Jewish or not? The requirement that is commonly asserted is that it's not safe at this point in time to assume that either the genetic mother alone or the nurturing mother alone is going to be recognized 25 years from now, when there will be some new Beit Din in Eretz Yisrael which will take upon itself the authority to determine questions of status that had been determined 25 years earlier and overturn them, that at that point, 25 years from now, they could go either way and likely would go in whatever is the other way as opposed to what had been determined 25 years earlier, and that therefore the only safe thing to do would be to convert the infant upon birth, which of course has other kinds of consequences in terms of marriageability and such. The same thing is true with regard to the halachic issues having to do with paternity. There still are poskim who maintain that the only basis, the only legitimate basis for halachic paternity is the act of intercourse. And that absent the act of intercourse, even in situations of artificial insemination by husband, there are poskim who still maintain that the sperm donor, who is the husband of the woman who will give birth to the child, is not considered halachically to be the father of the child because there was no act of intercourse. On the other hand, most commonly, position based on Shlomo Zalman Orbach and others, maintain that no, it's the sperm determines, and that therefore whoever is the sperm donor is the legal father of the, halachically the legal father of the child. Rav Moshe Feinstein, on the other hand, maintained that this vitur, that this legal capacity to waive paternity exists, and that legal capacity means that, for example, if someone is an anonymous sperm donor, that he has no claim to paternity, in which case there is no legal father according to halacha. He does not, Rav Moshe does not create a basis for saying that the husband of the wife who is the recipient of artificial insemination by donor would become the legal father of the child. But and the reality is that the argument that Rabbi Tendler is now making, essentially maintaining that paternity should be based on the whoever is the donor of the genes, that is the recognition that sperm is simply a delivery system for DNA, in which case it doesn't matter how the DNA eventually arrives. It could arrive from a mammary cell. It could arrive from a skin cell. It doesn't matter, because all sperm is a delivery system for the DNA, and therefore whoever is the originator of the DNA, whoever the DNA comes from, that person is the legal father. The reality is that at this point in time, we don't have any certainty whatsoever as to what determination a Beit Din would make, even if you got, if you were to have Tchiyat HaMesim of Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach and Rav Shaul Yisraeli and Rav El Yoshev, and you sat the three of them down to arrive at a determination, and they wrote a document saying that in this particular instance we decide that so-and-so is the father and so-and-so is the mother, odds are that 25 years from now a Beit Din will overturn that. And in the absence of some reasonable degree of certainty, the question of whether people can or to feel secure in the use of this technology is an extraordinarily serious question. Not to speak of the question that that Professor Loihi mentioned toward the end of the issue of the adultery question with regard to married women bearing the child which is born of DNA of a man other than her husband. Whether that should be considered adultery, should be considered suffic adultery, should be considered permissible according to Rav Moshe, so long as there was no actual act of intercourse, impacting on the status of the child, impacting on the status of the marriage. There are poskim according to whom, in situations of artificial insemination by donor, that there is a divorce needed because it's the equivalent of an act of adultery. All of these have remained essentially unresolved debates. And to these unresolved, sort of purely halachic debates, another layer of difficulty exists in regard to cloning. And that is the question of the impact of the study of and discussion of the social consequences of behavior and their impact of that on psak halacha. Now, we don't often talk about the question of the impact of social values on halacha, but the reality is that a careful study of tshuvot of poskim makes it very clear, that questions of social impact of particular conduct is deeply impactful on psak halacha. Whether it was the tshuva of Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, who opposed artificial insemination by donor altogether because he believed that it would undermine the family unit, that it would make marriage unnecessary. Rabbi Waldenberg argued, what woman would want to get married if she could have children without having to bear the burdens of a husband? Not yet, but who knows? But for that matter, earlier on, discussion already in the 1960s around the question of the pill as a contraceptive, where Rabbi Jacobowitz, early on in that period of time, opposed the use of oral contraceptives on the grounds that it would invariably result in the reduction of family size. And he argued at the time that particularly in that era, less than 20 years after the Holocaust, that Jews of the world had a duty to repopulate Jewish society. Rav Waldenberg, on the other hand, did not take that kind of approach, did not sort of factor in the sociological reality into his psak with regard to the permissibility of oral contraceptives. On the other hand, Rav Moshe Feinstein clearly did. Right? Rav Moshe Feinstein, despite the fact that he had initially taken the position that the only objection that he had to the use of oral contraceptives, assuming that it's a situation in which the postponement of childbirth is permissible, that he saw oral contraceptives as a fundamentally permissible mechanism by which to achieve the permissible goal when it was permissible of the postponement of procreation. Nevertheless, as soon as the question of mid-period spotting began to emerge as an issue, Rav Moshe immediately said, no, it is no longer permissible to use the pill as a contraceptive because the consequence is its interference with the sexual relationship between husband and wife. By 5 years after that, in the early 70s, by the time the medical community had sort of solved the problem of mid-period spotting, but had also identified a limited number of instances in which women using the pill would find themselves having embolisms and would have difficulty of that sort. Reb Moshe proceeded to forbid the use of the pill as a contraceptive. Right, this is now in the early 1970s. Right, so it's sort of in the heart of the period of the sexual revolution. Right, with Reb Moshe aware of what was happening in the external world, and suddenly Reb Moshe says, no, the pill is impermissible. The pill is impermissible. Why is it impermissible? Because it's too great a threat to women's health. And that tshuva was published, of Reb Moshe, was published in the same volume as the tshuva in which Reb Moshe said that smoking is not osur. So one would tend to suspect that there was some factor operating here other than either the scientific facts or the pure halakha. That what was operating there was a consciousness of an external social reality that he did not want to be perceived as supporting. The truth of the matter is that these kinds of social factors are not new in terms of the way in which they are weighed in halakha. Right in the middle of the 1600s, when Rabbi Yair Chaim Bachrach was asked the question of whether termination of pregnancy would be permissible for a woman who had conceived in an adulterous relationship, did tshuva recognize that if she continues the pregnancy, that her marriage will come to an end, that her relationship to her family will be destroyed, that her whole life will be ruined? And in that realization, did tshuva for what she had done and ask whether she could have authorization to terminate the pregnancy? And Rabbi Yair Chaim Bachrach wrote a tshuva in which he argued that in principle this would be permissible because it, based on the approach of many poskim who maintain that tsar ha'im, that maternal anguish and maternal suffering is sufficient to justify the termination of a pregnancy, that this was clearly a situation in which there was enormous maternal anguish involved in the continuation of the pregnancy, and therefore he should reach the conclusion, he said, that it should be permissible. However, he would not reach that conclusion, would not allow the termination of the pregnancy, said Rabbi Bachrach, because to do so would constitute a license to adultery. Right? Understand that is if every woman who committed adultery, if every married woman who committed adultery would then know that if she became pregnant, she wouldn't have to worry about it because she could terminate the pregnancy on the grounds of her anguish, then it would encourage, he was concerned, it would encourage pregnancy. I mean, it would encourage adultery. By the same token, of course, 100 years later, Rabbi Yaakov Emden dealt with an identical problem, and Rabbi Yaakov Emden reached the opposite conclusion, maintaining that he doesn't believe that this will encourage adultery in any way, but he does believe that the anguish of this woman needs to be relieved through allowing the termination of the pregnancy. For that matter, the intense debate between Rav Woldenberg and Rav Moshe Feinstein in regard to the question of termination of pregnancy when the fetus is afflicted with some disastrous disease such as Tay-Sachs, which Rav Woldenberg maintained that it was permissible to terminate the pregnancy until the third trimester, and Rav Moshe maintained that it was absolutely forbidden. And Rav Moshe wrote really polemically, vitriolically against the position of Rav Woldenberg. There's no doubt that Rav Moshe's vitriol and Rav Moshe's polemical writing in this regard was in part responsive not just to the question of the permissibility of termination of pregnancy based on fetal condition, but was based as well on the fact that at that point in time, in the mid-1970s, there was intense discourse going on, which has actually just recently been revived within the medical ethics community around the question of whether it should be permissible to terminate the life of a newborn within 30 days after birth based on a diagnosis of some dire, disastrous disease. And that, in effect, Rav Moshe saw himself as preventing not just termination of pregnancy, but preventing infanticide. And again, beyond these particular considerations, there's another sort of fundamental layer of deliberations that has also engendered enormous debate, and those are the theological implications The question of whether cloning constitutes an excessive interference in the divine order is not, I believe, a simple matter to be dismissed. While it's true that klayim is the only situation in Torah in which there is a limitation on human control of natural process as a symbolic affirmation of God's control over the natural order, right? The laws which prohibit klayim behema, which prohibit the crossbreeding of animals and which prohibit the cross-fertilization of seeds for vegetation and which prohibits the grafting of branches of different species of trees and also which forbids the wearing of shatnez, that all of those forms of klayim constitute fundamentally a symbolic affirmation which the Torah requires us to undertake, and within the context of an agricultural economy had enormous power and enormous significance to assure that we remain conscious always that there is a divinely created order, and that while it may be true that humans are empowered to exercise substantial control in the world, that doesn't mean that we are empowered to exercise total control in the world. And the question of what that line should be, of where exactly the line should be drawn, what is the point at which human beings in humility need to back off and say, no, this is an area which we should not control, whether it be simply because there needs to be such an area and in effect cloning might be the contemporary form of klayim, or whether it's because there are a variety of social fears that one needs to have in regard to cloning, which are fears that have been raised having to do with the creation of underclass, the creation of the perfect maid, the cloning of the perfect maid, and eventually the cloning of the perfect kindergarten teacher. And the perfect whatever that is of human beings beginning to exercise the kind of control over human generation that might serve to intentionally deprive human beings of a capacity that by chance they might otherwise have, but to deprive them of those opportunities because we want them to be doing something else which we determine they ought to be doing. Right? Do you follow what I'm saying in that regard? That question of the development of an underclass is a real question that we need to debate. And the truth of the matter is that these kinds of social considerations always have been taken into account in halachic determinations. It's not simple to say, well, you know, we can do whatever we can do. It is at the same time perfectly true that we recognize that this is God's world, but that we have extensive authority, and that the comment that Professor Loiki started with, and that is that the halakha recognizes that which is forbidden and presumes that that which is not forbidden is permissible, is a fundamental element of halakha. And that in that light, the answer that we need to, I think, offer is that we ought not to attempt to impede the scientific progress despite the complexities that we will have to confront that eventually will require resolution which might take a century to achieve, might eventually be achieved. But the way to deal with those issues is not to attempt to impede the scientific progress, but to attempt to assure that our religious and spiritual development keeps pace with our material progress. That if we can shape the character of our communities and our society so that the family values that we have, that the virtues that we deemed to be dear, that the social responsibility that we consider to be ours is so deeply rooted in us that we would not allow the use of the technology to override those factors. That then we can safely proceed. Then we can safely proceed to allow not only the scientific progress, but eventually the application of that scientific progress to help people in their lives. Thank you very much.
But in both of those areas, openness has evolved. So nowadays, open adoption is much more common, not only in terms of the openness to the adoptee, but also in terms of the openness in the biological parent or parents knowing who the adoptive parents are. And the same thing has happened now in regard to artificial insemination by donor. At one time, artificial insemination by donor was the person who was a sperm donor signed a secrecy agreement by which his identity could never be revealed. And now, open donation is quite common, in which the donors of sperm indicate that they would be willing in the future, some of them even desirous in the future, of knowing who their offspring are. And children born by artificial insemination by donor as was the case in the, up until in late by the late 1980s. Children who were adopted had the right in many states of the United States, including in New York, to gain information about their biological parents, even though those records had been closed at the time of adoption. The same thing is true now with regard to artificial insemination by donor. My assumption, therefore, is that these kinds of processes, by and large, come to be known, and that, therefore, they will get deliberated on, whether we like it or not. They will get deliberated on. I think it's unfortunate that the premise of comity, which once existed in halakha, in which a Beit Din would always presume the validity of the action of any prior Beit Din, whatever it did, and that is a principle which was explicitly formulated in regards to Gittin, which the halakha essentially forbade the challenging of a get subsequent, the validity of a get subsequent to its issuance. But it applied much more broadly than that in relation to virtually any status act done by a Beit Din. And that's now in Kingdom. The courts, but they did essentially in Israel, have overturned that entire idea and have taken unto themselves the right to review, and that's been happening now here in the United States as well, the right to review, to grant subsequent review to prior status actions rather than granting comity. So that's the reality. Now, should people under these circumstances hide this information? If they could, based on a psak that they had received from a reliable posting, if they could, I would not necessarily tell someone not to. But the reality is that these are all going to be up for grabs in the future.
Dan?
Anybody, what is the impact, role, or connection of eugenics as championed by the Germans, both the men, to what's happening now in Poland? Do they have a connection? Is there a danger?
Yes, that's a very relevant question. And the question is, how do eugenics relate to all these issues that they're doing in the And the issue really is very complex. So one area I'd like to focus on is the idea of enhancement versus therapeutics. I don't think anybody in this room would argue that genetic manipulation to cure a disease is unethical. But let's say you want to clone 5 million genes. Costs $1 million, it's a $5 million investment. In 20 years, you have a gas hoping $150 million. It's an investment. Is that allowed? Is it allowed to put in genes that enhance athleticism? Genes that enhance intelligence, I don't know if you can do it again. But there are a lot of genes out there. Risk management, you want your son to work with your daughter in Wall Street, you want to be a politician. There's even an adultery gene. I could go into a whole hour about that. I mean, would you want spouses to test for donor genes? So yes, one has to, I think, distinguish between enhancement and versus medical approaches. And that's where I think there's one line.
Now,
this is a really extremely stimulating presentation, Dr. Lipke. Dr. Lipke, your presentation was actually mind-boggling because, correct me if I'm wrong, if I understood correctly, you're predicting that in the not-too-distant future, we will be able to create viable human beings who are the products of embryos made by a single parent, or two women, or two men. It's absolutely mind-boggling. I'm not sure I understood exactly how that happens, but we can leave that for another time. My question is, if that's the case, that we will be populated by viable human beings who were created in this way, then what we know of what the Torah tells us, or what Jewish tradition and Jewish response over the ages tell us about the issues you mentioned, Kohen, Levi, Yisrael, parentage, all these things, will have to be totally reconfigured. I mean, what's going to happen to them, so is my question, if your prediction that there will be a viable world populated by people like this?
Also a very good question, and I'm sitting down here, I tend to usually deal with one issue at a time. So when I first presented all this stuff to him, he says, wait a second, let's just define the same one issue at a time. It's very complicated. But I want you to know, and I think what I've been with a little just like this, one of the beautiful things about the Talmud is it deals with hypothetical situations. Situations which we don't understand science, whether it's valid or not, but deals with situations. So, for example, in terms of Kohen, Levi, and Yisrael, there's a very famous Gemara in Horeb on Mount Zion that discusses what is the status of a bat lady who has relations with a boy and has a male child. And there's a machlokas whether the child's a lady or not. And there's a machlokas, one says yes, one says no, not a lady, but it's part of a particular event. And then the Gemara goes on and says, suppose you have a situation where a bat Kohen has relations with a non-Jew and has a male child. And there the Gemara seems to say it's a halal, meaning that intrinsically should have been a Kohen, even though there's no halakhic father. It goes to, it defaults, in a sense, to the halakhic. So these discussions are all over the Talmud. And you have cases in the Talmud of transplanting one embryo from one cow to another cow. I don't know how they do that. We can do it today, but they need to talk about it. And these hypothetical situations, or the Gemara in Chagiga talks about a woman getting pregnant by going to a bath. Faith in our science, I don't know how it could happen, but they discuss these things, they serve as a foundation, and I think it's a beauty to talk about, they serve as a foundation to address some of these very, very difficult problems. So, yes, we have the capacity to do it, it's going to take time. And I think one of the things which, as Rabbi Berman so beautifully said, I think one of the things we have to do is get a consensus. Is that have conferences, have people talk with who have different views. We, about 3 years ago, we ran a conference at Columbia on the halakhic definition of end of life. We had people who were favoring brain death, people favoring cardiac. And at the end of it was a wonderful conference. At the end of the conference, we sat all the speakers down in closed rooms, certain dinners, said, we're not opening the door until we come to consensus. And they came to a consensus that we published. They respect each other's opinions, but they came to a consensus we never would have expected. I'll just give you 2 points. One was that in end-of-life situations, the rabbi must see the patient. None of this calling the public phone. Number two, call on the phone, call the rabbi on the phone and say, what should I do? Do NDR, do not, etc. And the second consensus is that the rabbi has to speak to both the physician and the family members, not just by phone call. And these are very profound. I think that we have the capacity, whether in the future there will be a return, I don't know, I hope not, but we have that potential. I think it's a beauty of halakha. And I'll tell you something else that I should say outside this room, but whenever I speak out all over the world to Goyish audiences, they turn to us, we, as a Jewish people, are clearly intellectual leaders of medical bioethics, for sure, because we have that foundation.
Rabbi Berman, if I could just ask a follow-up question, a related question. To put it very simply and succinctly, does the Torah privilege a family in which there's one mother and one father? As opposed to, let's say, one of the cases that Dr. Blakey described, where you have two of one or only one.
Well, I mean, it's clear that the halakha presumes, that Torah presumes that, that the birth of a child will be the product of one father and one mother. And any other situation is an unusual situation. I don't believe that we will eventually have a world in which, you know, 70% of the population of people, you know, 70% of the world population will be people who are born by cloning. I think it will take much. It will be too expensive.
Obamacare.
But at the same time, I don't think that the Torah sort of innately precludes the possibility of a variety of other forms of family composition, so long as halachic standards in regard to whatever is involved are maintained. So if halachic standards are maintained, then it doesn't matter whether the family consists of two mothers and a father, or two fathers and a mother, or whether the parents of the child, and I think in this regard, Rabbi Bleich made a very important contribution by breaking people's presumption that parenthood means one father and one mother. The fact that he asserted that, oh, that's a convention, we're accustomed to thinking that way, but halachically it is certainly possible for there to be more than one father or more than one mother. I think that made an enormous contribution to the potential for moving in the direction of alternative kinds of family composition. At the same time, it's clear that the Torah presumes that a family will consist of a father and a mother and children. Certainly the bias of Torah, even in favor of monogamy, is a further reinforcement of that, despite the fact that the Torah itself did not preclude polygamy, but it's equally clear that there's a bias in favor of monogamy. So the fact that the Torah has a bias for a particular family composition means that it presumes that that's the natural mode of human conduct, but that it leaves room for exceptions depending on the circumstances of the society and of the reality, and I assume also, for the capacity for human creative activity, which generates this kind of scientific knowledge, which HaKadosh Baruch Hu also invested in us.
Two additions I agree with you completely. One is that one has to recognize that halacha was very forward-thinking in establishing that infertility is a serious illness. You learn that from Rachel, and it permeates throughout halacha. That's very important. And second thing is that we're seeing more and more abundant over the last 2 years, allowing a situation would never been allowed except for social change. And that is a single unmarried woman, age 40, who wants to have a child. And you see more of that abundant, allowing this woman to go through artificial fertilization and to have a child, even though she's a single woman. So you see the dynamic nature of halacha responding to the social climate, the whole landscape. And that's very impressive.
Could I just add something to that? I mean, the reality is that there's sort of an underground of psak that often pre-exists published material. There are many areas of halacha in which rabbanim are commonly aware that they collectively have been paskening in a particular way, despite the fact that there is really no supportive text on which they're basing themselves. In many instances, they're basing themselves on a conversation, a telephone conversation with a posek who says, yeah, okay, you can do this. And then that sort of spreads. And when it does, when that reality of sort of experience generates the awareness on the part of Poskim that the sky is not falling, that then you begin to get the published material that says, yeah, this is permissible.
Time for one more question. Rabbi Herman.
Change in technology and social networks impact on the decision-making either more conservative or more progressive. When people had channels as an underground network, it didn't lead your feeling to lack of confidence in the community that there was not enough reinforcement for the decisions that were taken. Because where's the world of technology and information flow, which is going to be out there? How do you see that affecting a lack of decision making at present?
Well, it's a really extraordinarily important question, because the reality is that the whole world of psak is being, did you hear it? His question was, we live in a world in which, technology, the technology of information sharing is itself a critical piece of the way in which information is shared? And how does that impact on the patterns of psak that exist? Now, the reality is that I believe that huge numbers of people now ask their she'elot of the internet. They used to ask their she'elot of their rabbi, and now they ask their she'elot of Rav Internet. And it is the case that there are probably some 20 to more, I'm sure there are probably 100, but you know, certainly more than 20 different responsible organizations that offer psak over the internet, where you can, you know, either fax or internet a she'ela, and you know, within 48 hours or so, you'll get a tshuvat or she'ela without their knowing who you are, without their knowing, you know, anything about you other than the formal question that you ask. And that in consequence of that, there's a range of stuff that's out there that is much broader in its opinion than anything that we've ever seen before in published material. So if in published material the range of opinion on a scale of 1 to 10, you know, you'll have outliers at 1 and 10, but the range of opinion is in the published material usually between, let's say, 4 and 7. All right, and almost all poskim are somewhere between 4 and 7. You have someone at 1 and someone at 10, and then you have someone who's at 0 and minus 2, but you know, him you don't even take account of, right? Now, with the material that's available on the internet, and people not feeling that they have to take responsibility in a community for the psak that they issue, the range of opinion is much broader. And so you'll find anything from 1 to 10 out there on the internet in almost equal amounts. And you know, poskim are having a very difficult time with that, because people show them, well, you know, but I heard, you know, or someone told me that someone said, or, you know, stuff like that. And I think that has a conservative, it has a conservative impact, because it makes people afraid to, you know, so responsible poskim afraid to spread their wings into those untested areas, because they'll be defined as an internet poskim, and they won't be taken that seriously.
Can I just add two things to that? One is, I'm no longer passing according to the internet. I have my iPhone here. You probably want to say Kahun, when it doesn't have Kahun, there must be right. But I'm more serious now. About 33 years ago, I'm sitting with Ravan Salavation. He gave a lecture, and we're sitting around. And my wife and I just gave birth to our daughter, Dua, and he was talking about education. And I asked him, Ravan Salavation, are we allowed to teach our daughter Gemara? This is 35 years ago. And he asks me the following question: are you going to send her to college? And I said, yes. So he said, not only are you allowed to, but you're obligated to teach her Gemara and Rava. And I said, wow. And then he said something, which of course I was too nervous to ask the more source. He says, if the Ramban were alive today, we would ask the Shaila, he would say, if you don't, you'd be over Nasei and Alo Kasei. I still don't know which I say, Lord, I say, it's what he said. And then I asked him, why don't you publish this? And he looks at me and says, because I want to stay alive.
So one more hand. Let me ask Susan to formulate one last question. And then in answering the last question, let me ask each of our guests to close with a concluding statement.
Okay, I will give our discussion about this question. Okay, you have all this artificial
dunk. Is there a danger that siblings
eventually could marry each other if you don't know who this
third is? Excellent question. Now I'm going to tell you something that I challenge you. Half brothers and half sisters, everybody assumes there's a huge amount of voice. And I challenge you to find that there's a small amount of voice. That's number one.
Small what?
Metaphorism. In terms of halakha, there is an option. One can do DNA testing. Just like you have it's over to, you know, you're insurance, you test your $65 and didn't pay that. You can, before you get engaged, you can test your sibling life for sibling relations. So there are ways, if you accept DNA, which is not universally accepted, there are ways of circumventing. It's very interesting that when I was at Einstein, there was a very famous OBGYN lecture that came to us. He was talking about IVF, and he said that he had this wonderful medical student who had great surgery, and he would use him all the time for any artificial insemination. And then 20 years later, he got this wedding invitation, and he looks at the names, and says, they're not familiar. Who are they? And he went past his records, and the same sperm donor who conceived the boy and the girl. So his ethical question for us was, does he tell the couple and the parents? I'll let you do that.
Let me ask Rabbi Berman to close.
So, most fundamentally, I think that we all need to learn and teach Torah with an eye to the position of the Rambam, who maintains that every mitzvah of the Torah has human purpose, and the human purposes are that we should know what's true as opposed to what's false in the world, that we should know what the personality virtues are so that we can maximize those virtues and reduce negative personality qualities, and so that we can produce a just society and avoid injustice. The Rambam maintains that every one of the 613 mitzvot of the Torah is designed to achieve one of those three or more, one or more of those three purposes. We teach an enormous amount of Torah. We learn collectively, and we often forget that what we need to know is not just the rules of the halakha, but God's ultimate purpose in what He wants of us in terms of the knowledge of what's true in the world and to deny that which is false, to work on our virtues, and to make sure that we produce the kind of society that will make God proud. If we do that, then all sorts of new technology will create no threat to us, because we'll know what we're seeking to achieve, we'll know what is true, we'll know what virtues we need to work on developing, and we'll sustain a just social order. And this is just one instance of that. If we know who we are and what we want in this world, then there's no threat here.
Like I said, I agree with what I've learned. I think one of the most impressive lessons I've learned from the right counter throughout our multiple decades of relationship is his humanistic side of himself. To quote my wife, if he says something is absurd, you know he's gone through it and is left with no alternative but say it's forgiven. Most of the times, we've had numerous situations, complex cases where he's found a lean method because of humanitarian considerations. That really impresses me. That's the first thing. And the second thing is that there's a real need to address these issues. And the only way we can do this is by what we did in the 60s and 70s, as sponsor, professors from Rabbanim to teach them the science, to teach them the halakhas, to engage, to support conferences where all these people come together and learn from each other. And in doing that type of format, people, as you know, don't read anymore, right? If they don't have online on the internet, they're not going to read any books. The idea of publication is going down. But they do attend conferences and lectures like this, coming together, inviting experts in the field, scientists are bonding together, sponsoring these type of conferences is going to be a very effective way for us to address this issue.
I want to thank Dr. Lucky and Rabbi Berman for this extraordinary evening. I want to thank Hannah once again for making this all possible. Extent our guests are still awake, you're welcome to come and talk to them more. And we're going to Dalvin Meyer here at the front of the room in just a moment.
What do you do?